Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
The line of cars waiting to receive boxes of food from the Houston Food Bank can be up to a kilometer long. Based in the state of Texas, the organization is the country's largest food bank. It is offering huge amounts of food to workers who have lost their jobs because of the coronavirus crisis, as well as other people in need. Herman Henton, an unemployed construction worker, is among those receiving food. His wife works at a home improvement store. She is now the only person in their family of five who has a job. The family tried to get food stamps, but they were told they could only have $25 of federal food assistance each month. As a man, as a father, as a provider, I felt at a low point. I felt low, Henton said. He was waiting in his car near West Houston Assistance Ministries, which gets food from the Houston Food Bank for its care packages. Food provided by the Houston Food Bank now averages about 800,000 pounds each day. 2 pounds is a little less than 1 kilogram. The organization reached the 1 million pound mark for the first time in the spring, a level it still sometimes reaches. Before the coronavirus crisis, the group's average daily distribution was 450,000 pounds. That information comes from Brian Green, president of the Houston Food Bank. Then, workers in Houston and millions around the country suddenly lost work and were forced to depend on the free food. It had that feeling of a disaster, like the hurricanes, Green said. It was shocking how the lines grew so quickly, he added. Houston is known as one of America's most ethnically and racially diverse cities. But it soon became known for something else, being in serious need. The food bank hurried to gather enough milk, bread, vegetables, and meat from a lot of places to feed the hungry. Many people in Houston and around the country do not make a livable wage. Their money is gone by the time they get their next paycheck. 22 million people across the country lost jobs when the coronavirus first hit. Close to 11 million of those jobs have not yet been restored. 40% of American families have less than $400 to pay for unexpected costs, Green said. The information comes from a study by the U.S. Federal Reserve System. So, when this crisis hit, the number of families who needed assistance was immediate and very large, Green said. After Henton lost his job, he and his wife ate one meal each day so that their three children could eat all three meals. His family is one of around 126,500 area families that the Houston Food Bank has helped with boxes of food every week since March. Workers and volunteers separate, load, and pack the food onto trucks. The trucks then bring the loads to distribution centers around the city and towns outside the city. Nationally, free food distribution has risen sharply and continues to stay high, noted Katie Fitzgerald. She heads the organization Feeding America, which runs a national network of 200 food banks. Her group increased the amount of food it distributes to 2 billion pounds from April through June. The federal government has helped meet the demand with programs such as Farmers to Families. The program buys farm goods such as vegetables, meat, and dairy that had been produced for restaurants that are now closed. It gives these goods to food banks and the distribution groups they work with. But the money for the U.S. Agriculture Department's Farmers to Families program runs out at the end of October. I'm Alice Bryant.
Kang Na-ra is in her Seoul, South Korea studio, preparing to record a YouTube program. The 23-year-old fled North Korea 6 years ago. Today, her YouTube channel has 20 million views. In her videos, she shares personal stories about life in North Korea. She talks about things such as women's rights, clothing choices, and the people who flee the country. She says she is trying to show South Koreans a side of North Korea they may not have seen before. In recent years, YouTube has seen a major rise in North Korean defector channels. North Koreans in the South have become more involved in telling their own stories. And they are getting lots of followers, said Sokil Park. He is with the group Liberty in North Korea. There's an appetite for broader stories, including about North Korean people, how they live their lives in a place which is so close to here, but which is completely shut off, he said. This growing interest has also affected the film industry. Movies and shows have often represented North Koreans as dangerous or simple-minded. More recently, the wildly popular television program Crash Landing on You tells of a North Korean soldier who falls in love with a South Korean girl. Many saw it as an unusually full image of the North. In Seoul, a light-hearted play tells the story of a separated family. Members accidentally meet each other at the border separating the two Koreas. Director Kang Ji-kwon said that in the past, South Koreans may have looked down on North Koreans or made fun of the way they speak. But now more shows are trying to inform people about North Korea. Tae Ho Lee was one of the performers in Kang's play. The actor said, "It's not just about some political sides arguing about certain things. It's not about that. People are people. And I think people in the South have generally really accepted that." But that acceptance only goes so far. And although defectors are getting more attention in the media, The attention is not always good. Oh Jin-ha is an artist who defected from North Korea. He said many film producers in the South represent North Koreans as creatures different from other humans. Back in her Seoul studio, Kang Na-ra is hopeful that can change. She said that since North and South Korea have been separated for so long, it makes sense they would feel distant from each other. But, she said, she wants to narrow that gap with her YouTube channel.
A NASA spacecraft that recently collected rocks from an asteroid captured far more material than expected. The American Space Agency says the sample was so large that it blocked the container door of the collector. The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft successfully completed its asteroid sample operation on October 20th. The explorer's robotic arm touched the asteroid Bennu for a few seconds to produce dust and rock samples for collection. Bennu sits about 320 million kilometers from Earth. The samples were then trapped in a device called the collection head. NASA discovered the blocked door of the device in images received from the team controlling the spacecraft. The blockage caused some asteroid material to escape back out into space. Because of this, NASA scientists made the decision to move up the timeline for completing the next step in the operation. This involves stowing or storing the collection head in a secure capsule within the spacecraft. Time is of the essence, Thomas Zurbuchen told reporters about the change in plans. He is NASA's associate administrator for science. The operation to stow the samples is carried out in a series of steps. After each step, the spacecraft sends information and images back to Earth. Different members of the team watch the process to make sure things progress correctly. The spacecraft is so far away that it takes about 18 minutes for its signals to reach Earth. Any communication from ground controllers requires the same amount of time to reach OSIRIS-REx. Because of this, the stowing process was expected to take several days. Scientists believe the operation captured up to 400 grams of asteroid material. This is far more than the 60 grams NASA said it hoped OSIRIS-REx would collect. But mission leaders said they will not know exactly how much material is inside until the sample capsule gets back to Earth. The team had planned to carry out a process to measure the sample. But that plan was canceled because NASA said it could have caused even more material to spill out. I think we're going to have to wait until we get home to know precisely how much we have, OSIRIS-REx lead investigator Dante Loretta told reporters. As you can imagine, that's hard, but the good news is we see a lot of material. Team members had also considered doing another collection attempt. But the leaking issue led NASA to decide against the plan. Quite honestly, we could not have performed a better collection experiment, Loretta said. OSIRIS-REx is expected to begin its return to Earth in March 2021. The trip will take 2.5 years, with the spacecraft's planned arrival set for September 2023. The mission marked NASA's first asteroid collection operation. Japan is the only other country to have successfully captured such a sample. Asteroids are among the leftover material from the solar system's formation about 4.5 billion years ago. NASA chose to collect a sample from Bennu because its carbon-rich material is believed to hold preserved building blocks of our solar system. Scientists say the asteroid samples may help them better understand how planets formed and how life began on Earth. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By February 1, 1861, 7 southern states had withdrawn from the United States of America. They created their own independent nation, the Confederate States of America. The South seceded because Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, had been elected president. Southerners believed he would support a constitutional ban on slavery. They were afraid their way of life would soon end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the beginning of Abraham Lincoln's presidency.
President-elect Lincoln traveled by train from his home in Illinois to Washington, D.C. Along the way, he stopped to make speeches. As he got closer to Washington, he was warned that a mob was planning to attack the train. He had to continue his trip in secret. Lincoln arrived in Washington 9 days before his inauguration. It was a busy time. He talked with many people, including delegates to a peace convention. Every state was represented at the convention, except the states that had seceded. The delegates urged Lincoln to support slavery. They urged him not to go to war over the issue. Lincoln said only that he would faithfully execute the duties of president of all the United States. He said he would protect and defend the American Constitution.
While Lincoln waited for Inauguration Day, he chose the members of his cabinet. He wanted men representing all opposing groups in the Republican Party. He hoped this would unite the party and give him support in the difficult years ahead. Lincoln chose William Seward as Secretary of State, Salmon Chase as Treasury Secretary, Gideon Welles as Navy Secretary, and Montgomery Blair as Postmaster General. Seward did not like Chase, Welles, or Blair. He told Lincoln that he could not serve in the cabinet with them. He said they would never be able to work together. Lincoln answered that he would be happy to make Seward ambassador to Britain instead of Secretary of State. Seward gave up the argument and agreed to join the cabinet.
Inauguration Day was the 4th of March. President-elect Lincoln rode to the ceremony with outgoing President James Buchanan. Buchanan was ready to give up his power. He told Lincoln, "If you are as happy to get into the White House as I am to get out of it, you must be the happiest man alive." The inaugural ceremony took place outside the Capitol building. Lincoln was to give his inaugural speech before being sworn in. He had worked hard on the speech. He wanted to say clearly what his policy would be on slavery and secession. These were the issues which divided the country. These were the issues which were leading the country to civil war. This is what Lincoln said.
"There seems to be some fear among the people of the southern states that because a Republican administration is coming to power, their property and their peace and personal security are threatened. There has never been any reasonable cause for such fears. In fact, much evidence to the contrary has existed, open to their inspection. It is found in nearly all my published speeches. In one of those speeches, I declared that I had no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I said I believed I had no legal right to do so, and no wish to do so. This statement is still true. I can only say that the property, peace, and security of no part of the country are to be in any way endangered by the incoming administration."
Lincoln noted that 72 years had passed since the first president was inaugurated. "Since then," he said, 15 men had led the nation through many dangers, generally with great success." He went on,
"I now begin the same job under great difficulty. The breaking up of the Federal Union, before only threatened, now is attempted. I believe that under universal law and the Constitution, the union of these states is permanent. This is shown by the history of the Union itself. The Union is much older than the Constitution. It was formed, in fact, by the Articles of Association in 1774. It was continued by the Declaration of Independence in 1776. It grew further under the Articles of Confederation in 1778, and finally, in 1787, one of the declared reasons for establishing the Constitution of the United States was to form a more perfect union. I therefore believe that, in view of the Constitution and the laws, the union is not broken. I shall make sure, as the Constitution orders me to do, that the laws of the Union are obeyed in all the states. In doing this, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none, unless it be forced upon the national government. The power given to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the taxes. But beyond what is necessary for these purposes, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere.
Lincoln then repeated some statements he had made during his campaign for president. He used them to explain the differences between North and South. One part of the country, he said, believes slavery is right and should be extended. The other part believes slavery is wrong and should not be extended. This, he said, was the only important dispute. Lincoln admitted that even if the dispute could be settled peacefully, there were those who wanted to see the Union destroyed. He said his words were not meant for them. They were meant only for those people who really loved the Union. He said,
"Physically speaking, we cannot separate. We cannot remove our sections from each other, nor build an impassable wall between them. A husband and wife may be divorced and go away from or out of the reach of each other. But the different parts of our country cannot do this. They must remain face to face, and relations, friendly or hostile, must continue between them. Is it possible to make those relations better after separation than before? Can aliens make treaties easier than friends can make laws? Can treaties be more faithfully enforced between aliens than laws can be enforced among friends? My countrymen, one and all, think calmly and well upon this subject. Nothing valuable can be lost by taking time. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the great issue of civil war. The government will not attack you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though emotion may have damaged them, it must not break our ties of love."
Abraham Lincoln then placed his hand on the Christian holy book, the Bible. The Chief Justice of the United States then spoke the presidential oath. Lincoln repeated the words, and the United States had a new president. Lincoln's first crisis came quickly. It was a problem left unsolved by the outgoing president. Lincoln had to decide immediately what to do about the federal fort in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina, Fort Sumter. The fort was surrounded by Southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the harbor. The federal troops inside Fort Sumter were getting dangerously low on food, but any attempt to send more men or supplies would be seen as an act of war, civil war.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.